May it please the Court, my name is Eitan Kaslyanich. I'm representing Michelle Herder in this matter. As you're well aware, in this case, the District Court actually remanded Ms. Herder's claim for a new hearing. But the report and recommendation that was adopted by the Court limited the new hearing to the taking of testimony from a vocational expert. The Court did not find any of the other errors that I had raised in court to be reversible error. And that's the reason I'm here today. Herder is asking this Court to hold that the ALJ did not just err by failing to take testimony from a vocational expert, but he also made many other very significant errors. These are all addressed in my brief. I'll briefly touch on a few of them. The first error that is very significant is Ms. Herder has many, many, many different impairments. Lots of things wrong with her. She's got congenital deformity. She's got hydrocephalus. She's got a lot. She's got depression. She has so many. It's a long list. Her treating physician, Dr. Seward, filled out several handwritten forms in which they're kind of hard to read because they go on and on and on detailing all of these many different problems that she's aware of that she has, that she's treated her for, that she's seen the reports from other physicians who have treated her on referral. Lots of different things wrong with her. In the ALJ's decision, he specifically mentioned about a half dozen of those of her impairments and specifically ruled these are not severe impairments. Well, that's not by itself reversible error, because if you say, these impairments aren't severe, as long as he found something severe and moved on beyond step two in the analysis, just merely stating that something's not severe is not reversible error. But he went further. Not only did he find these impairments to be not severe, he also didn't consider the limitations that were caused by these impairments. And then there were a bunch of other impairments, including the hydrocephalus, feet abnormalities, that he didn't even mention. And once again, the ones he didn't mention, he didn't factor them into his analysis in the rest of his decision. That's the first reversible error that I see here, is failing to consider all of those.
Counselor, you're looking for a partial remand. You're not asking the whole thing be reviewed again, right?
I actually am looking for, honestly, the evidence in this case would support the award of benefits, but it certainly supports a remand.
But you still have the question of amount at issue and terms, the duration.
These are possible questions that could be resolved at a remand hearing. Because this is an SSI claim, the dates that are at stake, that's at stake, is only from her application date.
Right, she doesn't get to go back.
Not but 2001, nothing like that. No, in fact, she originally alleged disability back to 2001 or something, but for purposes of this appeal, for the person in court.
Right. SSI can only get it from the application date forward.
Right, the month after the month of application, and so we amended the onset date to the month of the application. So no, we're not looking for the court to, or anyone, to look further back than that.
Except further back, some of the stuff that happened further back, you claim has an impact on how she performs now.
That is correct. And because, as an example, even when you're only, if you apply in 2006, alleging disability from 2006, and what happened to her, she had respiratory failure, was hospitalized for 11 days, was intubated for 11 days in 1999. She's terrified of that recurring, absolutely terrified. And so the ALJ doesn't even acknowledge that she had respiratory failure. Those words aren't in his decision. He says she was hospitalized for pleuritic pain. It wasn't pleuritic pain. She was respiratory failure. She was intubated. So that's an example of one thing that she had back then that still affects her. But most of the things that are affecting her now, another one that is very significant, she had back surgery. She had back in approximately 2002. The records, I don't think from the surgery are in the file, but there's all the references to it. There's MRI reports that show that she's continued to have significant pathology from this, including an annular tear. She's had, there was a neurologist found that she had sensory deficits that corresponded with three of her L3 through L5. And yet the ALJ just doesn't even address those issues, that he found that she had no postural limitations whatsoever, none. This is a woman who had back surgery, and it's documented that she has limited range of motion as a result of that, and documented that she's got the limited sensation that correlates with the results of that. So there's so much missing from the decision. That what's disturbing here is that under the district court's decision, that ALJ decision, which is not a very good decision, is essentially almost completely and totally affirmed. The only error that was found was that the ALJ didn't take vocational testimony on the issue of her environmental restrictions, doesn't mention the postural limitation, doesn't mention the medical records that document why she has postural limitations, gives no weight at all to her treating physician's opinion, none. Now, of course, under Social Security law and in law of the Ninth Circuit, the treating physician's opinion is entitled to the greatest weight. The treating physician's opinion is entitled to deference. But here, the treating physician's opinion gets no weight at all. Another error I addressed in my brief is a long laundry list of significant medical findings that are not mentioned by the ALJ. Now, I'll approach it from, if the ALJ had incorporated into his analysis, in his residual functional capacity, all of the limitations that arose from all of those medical findings, failure to just simply mention them all doesn't really matter. But once again, not only did he not mention any of that evidence, he also failed to incorporate the limitations into his residual function.
What was left out of the RFC?
Oh boy. The postural limitations, limitations on her ability to stand, which is a result of her congenitally deformed toes, short toes. Limitations arising from her depression, which sometimes she just gets depressed. Limitations arising from her migraines, which are under control with medication. She only gets them once a month, but when she takes her medication, there are side effects. So this is something that, it's one more thing that needed to be factored in.
So the RFC didn't contain, that didn't say, and an employee who once a month has migraine headaches.
Exactly. The fact that they are controlled with medication, you then have to factor in what are the side effects of the medication. As you testified that the medications, she would still be knocked out for several hours, even with the medications. The medications work, but they still knocked her out.
What else was left out of the RFC?
As far as postural limitations, it's well documented that she can't reach overhead. She's got shoulder problems. The ALJ found she didn't. That was a non-severe problem.
So she can't reach.
Right. She can't reach overhead.
Overhead.
One of the most significant things is she walks with a cane because she needs it. And it's documented, once again, she's got sensory deficiencies in L3 through L5. There was a physical therapist who did testing on her and found that she had gait abnormalities. The ALJ doesn't mention that evidence. The ALJ says, there's no evidence that she needs a cane. This is just a matter of choice and personal preference. It's not personal preference. She uses a cane because she doesn't want to fall, because she's got short toes, she's got the residuals of a back injury, and she can't get around without using a cane. The result of all of that, when you've got to get around using a cane, you can't do light work. The ALJ found which light work generally requires being able to stand for 6 hours in an 8-hour day. There is no way this woman can do that. unless you disregard all of the evidence.
I thought he said that, well, she used, he acknowledged that she used a cane, but there's no medical.
There's no evidence that it was prescribed to her.
Prescribed.
Right.
Isn't that right, what he said?
Yes, and then he went further and said, therefore she doesn't need it. So the fact that she has, once again, if you've got medical conditions that can reasonably be expected to cause you to have an inability to stand, inability to walk without relying on a cane, and you testify, I need to use this cane because, and here's why, my back hurts, I'm afraid I'm going to fall, I use a cane, then I don't fall. That's the analysis that the ALJ was required to take, but the ALJ didn't mention the evidence that supported why she would need a cane, and then he said, well, she's just using a cane because she wants to. I'm going to disregard that she actually needs a cane, and that's actually one of the most significant shortcomings of the residual functional capacity assessment. It doesn't include her need to use a cane. So what I'm asking the court here to do...
You've got a remand already.
Yes.
You got a remand on the at step five.
Right.
Right? So you want a remand at least that says, and redo the RFC as well.
Exactly. That's at the very minimum. And to redo the RFC, you've got to look at the medical evidence. You've got to look at what her doctor says. You can't give no weight at all to her treating physician. You've got to look at all the evidence of the history that shows why she has what she has. And you've got to listen to her testimony. And with the remand that we have here, if I weren't standing here today, I've had this happen before. You get your new hearing, and the judge says, I won't even take testimony. I don't have to. I'm not going to look at the evidence. I don't have to. Oh, new evidence? I don't care. The court said the only thing that was wrong was that one thing, and that's all I'm going to do. And in this case, that's affirming a bunch of nonsense, the ALJ decision it's not supported by substantial evidence when you view the record as a whole, and it's got just full of legal errors based on not applying the correct legal standards.
Okay, do you want to save the balance of your time for rebuttal?
I do, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Willie Lee for Commissioner of Social Security. I hear two lines of questioning, one about the relief, one about the underlying evidence. I'll address one or the other first at your preference, Your Honors, or I'll just address the evidence.
Let me ask you one question on the relief part.
Yes, sir.
So the district court ordered it remanded.
Yes.
At step five, essentially, for... testimony of vocational expert. Is that right?
Yes.
I guess on remand, she should be treated as a 50-year-old approaching advanced age?
Right.
As opposed to a 47-year-old?
Right. Her age has changed, and so we...
So when it gets back, they have to evaluate her based on her age at the time. Do we need to make that clear?
No, that's presumed. I mean, we're not limiting the period of review on remand to up to the date of the ALJ's decision. It's SSI, it's continuing. We're going to take her age as it is then, and maybe it comes out to a different determination based on the existing RFC. But I think I'd like to make one thing clear, is that on remand, they can present, a claimant has the right to present any evidence, even if it wasn't even raised on the prior proceeding. That's guaranteed by our regulations, 20 CFR section 416.1483.
So when counsel says the judge that the remand is not going to list anything else except what the remand was about, he's wrong?
He's not wrong. I mean, I'm not doubting that that's ever happened. If that happened, the ALJ would be incorrect to do so. But to say that that's grounds for relief right now is
let me make sure, because I've seen this in other SSI, SSA cases, and
yes.
I'm just kind of curious. So when we send it back for, let's say, further work step four.
Yes.
Or step two. We send it back. They can do a complete rehearing? I mean, just
Start all over.
Yes.
Is that the usual practice?
It is, but not because of any prescribed rule. What usually happens in that case, I think I should preface it like this. There are two main inquiries in a disability analysis. One, based on the medical and testimony, the medical evidence and testimony, what can that person do physically and mentally? We come up with an RFC. From that point on, once that's settled, we can then take everything, take those findings, which usually aren't an issue anymore, her age and her education level, then compare it to a vocational analysis and say, okay, based on all these factors, what can she do work-wise? So when a court remands before the RFC is settled at a point in which, say, step two, step three, or anything affecting the medical evidence or the credibility analysis, that undermines the RFC, and therefore, because the RFC has to incorporate all the evidence, the practical effect is it does start over.
But the RFC here is not, it's settled as far as the judge is concerned. It's only coming back for one step to have a vocational person talk about jobs. Right. So how do you argue that the RFC is not settled in this case? Or it is settled in this case. It's settled.
It is settled. That's the default position to begin with. If Ms. Herder doesn't present any new evidence, which is her right to do, on remand.
She has a right to present new evidence for the RFC on remand.
Yes, yes. But if she doesn't, and I don't think that's very likely, if she doesn't, then we're entitled to rely on the affirmed RFC from the district court and proceed from there, you know, because otherwise nothing else has changed.
It strikes me that if she can go back with the remand she's already got and relitigate her whole case, why are we here?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor.
Sort of like this.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's an advantage to having a default place to begin with. Law of the case, rule of mandate, a district court has affirmed these findings. So if those findings, leading to RFC, so if those findings aren't disturbed on remand by any new testimony or any new evidence, then that's where we start from. We're entitled to do that.
Let me ask you this. So I don't know if I'm calling it the right thing, but the vocational grids?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So with her new, with her now approaching advanced age,
right,
50 to 55 or whatever it is, with this RFC and her educational background, do you have an idea where she might land? Not disabled?
I believe so. I think once she turns 55, and this is all, we can all verify this later, but once she turns 55, I think with even a light RFC, she might be found disabled anyway. But that's, I think, 2 or 3 years from now.
She's about 52 now, right, or 51?
I think so, yes.
When I get reversed by the Court of Appeals and they say I should do a new sentencing, I don't do a new trial. I don't understand how in the Social Security world you get reversed and you say do step five again, you go back to steps 1 through 4. I'm missing something.
Well, by the district court's order, we're not required to, if that's affirmed, we're not required to start over if this court affirms the underlying evidence supporting the RFC. The thing is, in a disability case, this new evidence comes in all the time. I mean, a person's condition changes. We have accommodations for those situations. It's a natural part of the process. So if she does present new evidence, I think your concern is whether we're technically violating the district court's order. And I don't think it is. I mean, we err on the side of caution with regards to
So would the onset be, let's say it goes back down.
Yes.
And the ALJ says, oh, she comes in with new evidence.
Yes.
And it's, wow, it's convincing. And he says, yeah, you're disabled. Now, does he then pick the onset date? Could it be a date different from her application? Could it be that, you know, like a year before the new hearing while this case was on appeal?
Yes.
Is that what happens?
That could happen, yes. It doesn't have to be the date that she alleges onset. It could be. It could be another date because new evidence comes in that she has another recent injury or something. That's entirely possible, too. And going back to my comment earlier, Judge Collins, I didn't mean to say err on the side of caution. We want to give claimants the benefit of any change in the intervening circumstances. So we're not holding her to this RFC that the district court affirmed. If she presents new evidence, you know, that's not a given that we're going to say, no, we're denying you from presenting anything new. We're not changing what the district court found. That's just not the case.
Can the ALJ prevent her from putting in new evidence since she's only being remanded for that step?
No. By regulation, she's allowed to present anything she wants, whether or not it was litigated the first time around.
Does he have to consider it? He or she have to consider it, the ALJ?
Yes, he considers it, but I think the key, speaking of advantages to the government, the key advantage there is that if the ALJ decides, well, this doesn't really change what happened, what I determined before, I can still rely on my reasoning, which was already affirmed by the district court. Yes, he has to consider it, but he doesn't have to change his findings.
Right. So he argues that let's start with the RFC for just a moment. He argues that the RFC here was not correct because it didn't pick up other limitations, even those that may have derived from her non-severe impairments.
Right.
The ALJ says, well, I've considered everything in formulating this RFC here. This looks like a kind of a standard RFC from what I've seen in the past.
Yes. There's an assumption there that just because you have an impairment, it must indicate some level of impairment or limitation or a limitation at all. And I don't think that's proper to do. Just because you have short fingers or toes doesn't mean...
Well, I got the impression from reading the record about the congenital defect that it did cause her some problems walking and wearing shoes.
Some reports said that, but then some other doctors said she could walk on her heels, she could walk on her toes, she didn't have any problems with her gait. I mean, that's the kind of evidence that, the conflicting evidence that we have to weigh all the time. So, yeah, I mean, I don't deny that there's evidence of her having problems, but the ALJ weighed it, and I think it was reasonable for him to conclude, especially based on the examinations of Dr. Rao and Dr. Brack, that hey, look, she claims she has these, well, I mean, she has these problems. She claims she has these limitations from them, but we just don't see it.
Were Rao and Brack actually, they were not treating physicians, correct? Did they actually examine her?
They examined her, yes. I don't think they were treating her, though. They were just
They were examining doctors.
Yes, they were examining doctors.
Rao was an examining doctor. He examined her, correct?
Yes. I think I picked up in the ALJ's decision that he considered Dr. Brack as treating, but I don't think that was accurate. I think they're both examining doctors.
And the 15-year treating physician was given pretty much no weight.
Yes, because what she concluded was not, it was just totally contradicted by the other findings of the other doctors. I mean, she has back problems, yes, but Dr. Rao, I believe, said that she could touch her toes with her fingers, bend down and touch her toes. She had no indications of any findings or symptoms on straight leg testing, in which you're sitting down, you put your legs up and you simulate bending, but while you're sitting or lying down. There are actually five reasons that the ALJ gave to reject Dr. Siebert, the treating doctor. One of them, which the district court already rejected us on, saying that Ms. Herter basically dictated.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that was already rejected. So this evidence has been weighed. It has been reviewed. And
so if the district court rejected that argument, what's the ALJ going to do now?
Well, there were other remaining reasons that the ALJ relied on that the district court affirmed in rejecting the treating doctor. That they were inconsistent, that her findings were inconsistent with other doctors, Drs. Rao and Brack, the diagnostic findings, her own treatment notes, and the fact that she largely relied on Ms. Herter's subjective reporting, and the ALJ found that Ms. Herter was not entirely credible in what she was claiming.
How does the ALJ know that the doctor relied on Ms. Herter's reporting?
I can't recall what was stated in doctor's...
I thought that all went back to the allegation that Herter told her what to put into the report.
Right, there was that, and I think there were references to Dr. Seward said, see this attached report, but that report was actually just a history of Ms. Herder's subjective complaints and her medical tests and things like that. So that was the basis upon which the ALJ said, hey, this doctor just repeated what the claimant was stating. So I don't think credibility was touched upon very much here, but I don't think I need to get into that now unless Your Honors have questions about that.
You mean about rejecting Herder's credibility?
Right, right. Again, the ALJ gave several reasons, one of which was already rejected by the district court. So, you know, it's been reviewed, it's been weighed. I think it should be affirmed again because Ms. Herder has not raised anything new, any new arguments on appeal here. Finally, this topic about not discussing evidence, I don't think that's even supported by the record itself. I mean, the ALJ cited all these reports from which these individual findings Ms. Herder's raising now, they were already discussed. Just because the ALJ doesn't line up every single finding and say, okay, I consider this and that and that and that, that doesn't mean that it wasn't considered. The assumption, another assumption there that Ms. Herder is making is that, once again, these findings indicate something not already encompassed in the RFC or that they even produce any limitations at all. So that's all I prepared. So unless Your Honor has anything else.
I have no further questions. Thank you very much, counsel.
Give my time. Thank you.
Counsel says you don't need to be here because you're going to get a new hearing anyway.
Not true. We'll get a new hearing, but the new hearing will be a denial. I can write the decision for you today. It would take me about 5 minutes because I could cut and paste the old one. It would find that her that there'd be a vocational expert. They would testify, well, there's plenty of jobs somebody can do if all they have is environmental limitations. The ALJ will say, under the law of the case, the court has affirmed my RFC finding. They've affirmed my entire analysis has been affirmed. Therefore, I'm not going to do it again. Why should I? And why should he, honestly? I think the mistake here is in the district court's decision in affirming, in fact, kind of all of those mistakes that were made by the ALJ. Now, I want to quickly address the conflicting evidence issue regarding her ability to walk. There is conflicting evidence on that. But if an ALJ is going to say, oh, well, Dr. Rao says she can walk, so therefore she can walk without she doesn't need a cane, ALJ's also got to mention the conflicting evidence. He doesn't mention that the physical therapist found that she couldn't walk and that she had gait abnormalities. Doesn't mention it. He could have mentioned it, say, well, he says this, she says that, I'm going to accept this and here's why. He didn't do that. He just ignored the evidence that contradicted his analysis. I'm going to read you something real quickly. You'll see it eight times in my brief. December 2003, Dr. Iyengar found that sensory exam revealed hypesthesia in left L3, L4, L5 distribution. That's significant. My reply brief, point by point, lists 10 points of evidence that were not mentioned. If that evidence means nothing, then the government's argument is correct. So what? But it does mean something. The ALJ didn't mention any of that, and he didn't factor it in. He didn't explain why. The commissioner has a novel argument that I addressed it in my brief. I didn't mention it before about there were supposedly handwritten notations saying with the ALJ's initials throughout the file. That's not his initials. It's S. It's the doctor. The treating doctor looked at all those reports and submitted them. And so that's a mistake. We didn't bring it up before, but it's obvious if you look at her reports and how she signs her name. It just showed that she was reviewing all of the evidence, all of the reports from all of the referral people. With regard to credibility, this woman is a credible witness, and you can't analyze credibility if you're not analyzing the medical evidence correctly. So in conclusion, I do just ask that this case should be remanded. The proper step is, I've been told, is called step 3.5, because before they have, it's a 5-step thing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, before step 4, they have to do the residual functional capacity evaluation. There should be a new RFC assessment, which takes into account all the evidence that's here and any new evidence she provides as well, all at once.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. The matter will be submitted, and that ends our session for today and for the week, and thank you all very much.
Thank you.